Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, award-winning journalist and first-time biographer Patty Hartigan talks about her book, August Wilson, A Life. Published by Simon & Schuster in August 2023, this biography explores the life of a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who chronicled African-American life during the 20th century. So I asked Patty Hartigan how she decided to begin telling August Wilson's life story.
I discovered in my research that Wilson paid a price for every play he wrote. And there were friends from Pittsburgh back in the day who resented him for being what they called the chosen one. And it hurt him. And so I started at a moment in his life. It's 2003. He's at the top of his game. He's already August Wilson in quotes. He's written these wonderful plays. And he is not allowed to speak at his friend's funeral. And everybody else is. And It really, I found a photograph of him and he looked torn. But then going back in time, August Wilson's family, his great-grandmother, his mother and his grandmother, all lived on a mountain in Appalachia, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And Wilson never went there. But the story of his grandmother and that place is so uncanny that things show up in the plays. And then I go even further back and find his great-great-grandfather, who was originally an enslaved person in North Carolina and then made a lot of money and did great things and never knew that he was going to have this great-great-grandson. But yeah, it was important because in Wilson's masterpiece, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, the lead character, Harold Loomis, was on a chain gang for 7 years. In that community in Spruce Pine, North Carolina, while his great-grandmother and his grandmother and his mother were living there, there was a person on a chain gang who was accused of a rape that most likely he didn't commit. He was convicted in 5 minutes and he was sent to the electric chair.
Wow.
And Wilson didn't know that. So he said he wrote from the blood's memory, and that's the whole point of that chapter, is that it was in his blood. He used names. Cutler was a family name. His grandmother was Zanya, and she's in Joe Turner as a little girl. That's the name. So it was really, really important. And sometimes it was spine-tingling, especially with that past. The man who owned the plantation where Wilson's great-great-grandfather was an enslaved person, in his will, he bequeathed his daughter a piano. And there's a play called The Piano Lesson.
Right.
And you find out things like that and you're alone, you know, doing your research and you scream. he said all the time he wrote from the blood's memory. And as the more and more I dove into his life, it was so true.
Well, let me piggyback on that because you also open up the book with a quote from him where you write, "There is a way under, around, or through any door." So why did you use that quote at the very beginning, before even the prologue or the first chapter, to really get us into Wilson's life?
He surmounted every obstacle. It is a motto for his life. It was said to him by an artist. She applied to Carnegie Mellon, and she didn't get in because of the color of her skin. So she modeled for the painting class. And she listened to everything that professor said. She went home. She made her paintings. She showed them to the professor at the end of the semester. He got her a full scholarship.
Wow.
So that was under, around, and through every door. I mean, you think about his life. And he came from nothing. It's the quintessential American story. And he found a way through, around, and under every door.
He did.
Then the door was open to him in the end.
Okay, your long association with Wilson goes back to your time as a reporter and arts critic. What drew you to him?
I first met him in 1987 at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center, where he developed his plays. It's a wonderful place where new work is developed. And I had a grant. I was there as part of the National Critics Institute. He didn't have a play that summer, but he came anyway. And he spoke to the critics, and then we got to talking, and he talks and talks and talks. And I thought I was a genius because he was telling me all these great stories. And later on, I discovered he told the same stories to everybody. And then he developed his plays through the regional theaters, and one of the stops was the Huntington Theater in Boston. And by that point, I was a critic and an arts reporter at the Boston Globe. So he was so prolific. He had a play almost every year in those early days. And so I'd see him. I'd either interview him or I'd see him in the theater. And that's how I got to know him. And in 2005, when he was working on the 10th play, Radio Golf, he was about to turn 60. The Boston Globe magazine sent me out to Seattle to interview him and do a major retrospective of his work and his life. That was in early February. He was diagnosed with terminal liver cancer in May. He didn't know, but I think he knew in the same way he had the blood's memory. I think he knew that there was something wrong.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was he like as a person? Was he open? Was he fairly guarded in his interviews? How was he?
He was soft-spoken. He was funny. He could be a little disconcerting because he'd be talking as August Wilson, the playwright, and then suddenly there'd be this other voice. And my instinct is, how come I have no idea what's going on here? He went into character. He was talking about Radio Golf. He became a Sterling, a character in the play. And I've heard from many other people that he was like that with them, too. Mm. He could hold back his anger in public situations. Privately, he would say things. And there were a few subjects that he really didn't like to talk about. He didn't like to talk about his biological father, Frederick August Kittle. Mm-hmm. He didn't talk much about his first marriage to Barbara Burton. And, you know, he'd have a standard one line. He also really didn't like when people pointed out that he was half white, mm-hmm. biologically, because he identified as black. And any human being has a right to choose how they want to identify. And people pestered him all the time about this, all the time. So those were things where he held the line. On other subjects, he was a myth maker and he could tell stories. He was a storyteller on the page and in person.
So as a storyteller and as a wordsmith, it seems like he would have been an excellent student. But you also reveal in your book that he had a serious issue with education and the education that he received in Pittsburgh. So can you talk a little bit about how those experiences helped to shape him?
Those experiences partly scarred him, but they also drove him. So the first one was at Central Catholic High School, which is an elite college preparatory school. He got in, he tested really well. The school actually gave me the photograph of his class, his ninth grade class.
And
he's the only African-American in the class. He's got his head down. He's looking like he's trying to hide because every morning he got notes on his desk and he was taunted. And August Wilson did have a temper. And there was one day where he just couldn't take it anymore. And fists were flown and he walked out and he never went back. Then his mother was a great believer in education, Daisy Wilson. He went to a technical high school, which different from how they are now. They were really vocational high schools. And she said, go learn how to be an auto mechanic. My brother's an auto mechanic. He makes a lot of money. So he got stuck in metalworking where he made tin cups all day. And they did have academics in the afternoon. And he said, man, they're doing fifth grade level work. He left that school too. And then finally he ended up at Gladstone High School where he wrote a paper on Napoleon. And he knew he was the smartest kid in the class. And he had footnotes, and he researched it, and he typed it. And the teacher, who was black, said to him, you're either getting an A or you're getting an E, which was what we call an F now. And August Wilson was just horrified. Of course I wrote it. And he would not defend himself any further than that. And the teacher wrote E on it. He tore it up, and he left the school. He went back 3 days in a row, hoping that somebody would say, this smart kid, what's he doing out there playing basketball? Why isn't he not in class? And nobody did. Nobody cared. He was invisible. Mm. And so he went to the library and he taught himself. The man, honestly, he had read everything there was to be read. He's one of those people when you have a conversation, you're asking about conversation. The references could be anything. And he went to that library, and later on he got the Carnegie Library in Pittsburgh gave him an honorary high school diploma.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he treasured that more than he treasured his honorary doctorates.
Wow. So what kind of research did you do specifically to get into his family background? Because it's, you know, when you're talking about his earlier life, how much documentation was there?
For the great-grandmother and the grandmother, there are census documents. There are land documents. His cousin, Renee Wilson, had done a lot of the family genealogy, and she and I went there, and we climbed that mountain. And again, it's, you know, you get these goosebumps. And the hearth of Eller's cabin was still there. And we had a local person who played in those mountains when he was a young boy, and he knew where they lived.
So, and that was the cabin that his great-grandmother
lived in. Yes, the cabin that his great-grandmother lived in. In terms of Wilson, one time I was in Pittsburgh interviewing someone he knew more when he was in his 20s. And he said, well, you should talk to my brother. He was in kindergarten through maybe sixth grade. And so I found him. And there were things he told me that I had never known. Because August Wilson, there are many, many articles that say that his mother, Daisy Wilson, was married to Frederick Kittle. And she didn't marry him until way later. He had another wife. But Wilson didn't dispel those myths. Mm. And so the things you find out, and in terms of documents, I had to go to a lot of courthouses. I pulled death certificates, I pulled wills, marriage records, and there are a lot of different courthouses where these documents are. And so there's a lot of running around, but it's so exhilarating to find a fact right there. You know, I also pulled divorce papers. I mean, there are just so many papers. That's not from his childhood, but
right.
Well, for his mother, actually. Mm-hmm. I got her marriage certificate when she finally did marry Frederick Kittle, and she married him when he was dying. Mm-hmm. She married him so his children could get government benefits.
Wow.
Savvy woman, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. She looked after her kids.
Yeah. She did. So here's the question for you, I'm sure. And for my own biography about another African-American man, you know, the question is, okay, as a woman, how do you write about a man? And as a white woman, how do you write about a black man and get inside his head?
It's interesting. We were just on a panel talking about method acting. And I mean, I'm not Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, walking around like Abraham Lincoln, but you absorb so much. I talked to probably about 200 people. I was a part of the theater myself, and I didn't know him. I would never say I'm writing in his voice, but I think you do more research. You know, I get this question a lot, and usually the question comes from white men. You know, and you work harder. You read everything you can. You don't stop researching. You never stop going. And this book came out in 2023. He died in 2005. Mm. And I looked around at, why isn't there a biography of this great playwright? Somebody had to write the biography. And he actually told people at the O'Neill, I know that he did insist on a black director for Fences. It was the first movie, and he knew that film would be seen by more people than had ever seen all of his plays. That was important to him. But at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center, he told playwrights, there was one playwright who was a jazz singer, and she wrote a play about the jazz scene. She was white. There were black characters in the play, and everybody was sort of questioning her. He defended her, and then all the questions stopped. And the same thing with his friend James Yoshimura, who wrote a play about a basketball team, and it was half black and half white, and he's Japanese-American. And Jimmy said to him, can I do this? And Wilson said, you could write about whatever you know. You just got to make it good.
That's great advice.
Yeah.
For anybody who doesn't know, who was August Wilson as a playwright? What made him as significant as he was?
He wrote 10 plays, one for each decade of the 20th century, about the African-American experience. I would say that he is arguably the most important American playwright of the second half of the 20th century. He started out as a poet, and there are poetic monologues that you could take as standalone. Mm-hmm. And many actors do, they use them for auditions. but he tapped a nerve. He wrote about a community, and he said that he wanted to take ordinary Black Americans and turn them into kings and queens. And he succeeded in that.
I think
so
he did.
Beautifully.
Right.
And no other American playwright has done this. Eugene O'Neill was going to write a series of 11 plays. I think he wrote two, and then he destroyed whatever was left of the others. No one's done it. He did something that was important for the beauty and the power of his writing, but also for the subject matter. If you go back and you look at those plays, you look at Two Trains Running, this is 25 years before the dominant culture woke up with George Floyd. There was a young boy who was killed by policemen, and the people protested. And they said, okay, we'll do something, and that was it. So he was writing the truth as he knew it. And his first director, very influential, the wonderful Lloyd Richards. And I was interviewing Lloyd Richards, and he said, Patty, last night there was a white couple at the theater, and they came up to me, and they said, we've never been invited into a Black family's home. Thank you for inviting us.
What made Fences such a seminal work? I mean, I know he saw that as the play that could become a film that could then reach a larger audience.
Actually, Fences was his least favorite play.
Really?
Yeah. He had written Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which blew the world away, those monologues. And, I mean, it's a talkie play. There isn't much that happens.
That's true.
And so a lot of critics behind his back, and probably to his face, said, you can't write an Arthur Miller play. You can't write a well-made three-act play with a tragic hero. And so he said, oh, yes, I can. And you created Troy Maxson.
And for people who don't know.
Troy Maxson is the tragic hero in the play. He was a very talented baseball player in the Negro Leagues, but he was not allowed to go to the major leagues because Jackie Robinson hadn't broken the color line yet. And he was bitter about that. And the play revolves around Troy Maxson. And there are beautiful monologues. There's beautiful imagery. And it's accessible because it is one of those familiar plays. It doesn't have the same spirituality that Joe Turner's Come and Gone has and that The Piano Lesson has. It's very accessible, and it has some really great monologues, especially Rose's, when her husband cheats on her, comes home with the baby because his girlfriend died. She says, that baby has a mother, but you a womanless man. And every woman, I'm telling you, every single time I've seen that, every woman in the house, you tell him, baby. And everybody stands up and roars. So I think that's why. But he felt that he had not sold out, but he felt he wrote a play to answer his critics.
Mm.
And he did say to me that it was his least favorite. Hmm. And most people would think it's his favorite.
Yeah.
Joe Turner's Come and Gone was his favorite. And I think it's his masterpiece.
Why?
Because of the spirituality in it, because it goes back in time. It goes back to the Middle Passage. And there's a bloodletting in somebody's reinvents himself, rechristens himself. And it's also funny doing all these things. I had not met Wilson yet. I saw it at the Huntington Theater. And at the end of the play, there was about a minute and the audience was stunned into silence because people had never seen anything like this before. And then everybody leapt to their feet. And it was a moment. It was one of the most important moments I've had in the American theater. And he just captures everything in one play. The writing is profound. The characters are great. It's his masterpiece, and he agreed with me. So.
And it's wonderful you had a chance not to just to interview him once, but several times.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh plays a major role in this series of plays, these 10 plays. So did you, in terms of your research, go to Pittsburgh often?
I went to Pittsburgh a lot. I am not a great driver in places where I don't know where I'm going. I get lost. So Nelson Harrison, who is a composer, he was a sideman for many of the great jazz bands, had written some music for a musical that Wilson wrote called Black Bart and the Sacred Hills. So I met up with Nelson. He was in his 80s, and the man can drive. And so when I was there, I'd say, Nelson, I'm going to get lost again. And he'd either drive in front of me or I'd go with him. I went to all the places where the plays were set, went to the archives at Pitt. You know what? Pittsburgh is really a character in the plays. And the interesting thing is he had so many scars from his childhood. And he was a poet when he was living in Pittsburgh as a young man in his early 20s. And he had to leave Pittsburgh to hear the voice of Pittsburgh. Mm. And it was then that he stopped writing the highfalutin, classically references in his poetry and started to write about the people of Pittsburgh. And 9 of the plays are set in Pittsburgh. Ma Rainey is not set in Pittsburgh. That's set in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of research, you mentioned archives. Are there August Wilson archives at a set place, or are there many places that you had to go to find them?
His archives were not open yet. They're at the University of Pittsburgh, where they should be. I had already done the copy edit on the book, and it was ready when the archives opened. And so I begged, and I got a few extra days. And God bless librarians. There was one unpublished trilogy that he had written, and I had 2 of the plays. I couldn't find any existence of the 3rd one. And I just wanted to check that fact. I didn't want that fact to be wrong. The librarian went through 800 legal paths that hadn't been cataloged yet and found a reference where he named the 3 plays in the trilogy. That was remarkable. However, there are archives at the University of Minnesota from Penumbra Theater, where he did a lot of his early work. Lloyd Rich's archives are at the Beinecke at Yale. Mm-hmm. And he saved every single birthday card, Lloyd Richards. And he saved original scripts. He had, going through the archives, I'm sure you've done this. It's just another joyful thing. You're in this quiet room and you can only look at one piece of paper at a time. But when you find the piece of paper and you scream, everyone in the room understands.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there was a lot. There was a lot of back and forth. There was a lot of traveling in addition to all the interviews. And the documents don't lie.
Mm-hmm. So did you have access to the family? I know that you write in your epilogue that you weren't granted permission by his estate to use some of his personal letters and writings.
Right. Originally, the book was, in quotes, authorized, but it didn't work out. There were things that I just couldn't agree to. So I was not granted permission to quote anything that's unpublished. If I write you a letter, you own the piece of paper, I own the words. So all of his unpublished writings is owned by the estate. So I had to paraphrase the words of August Wilson. How do you do that?
That's tough.
That's tough. The man was a poet. And his letters. I had to paraphrase anything that was unpublished, including poetry. Oh, speaking of archives, I forgot to mention, I found a 75-minute CD at the Heinz Library in Pittsburgh that I just happened upon. And it's a poetry reading from 1975 of August Wilson reading his poetry. Mm. I transcribed every single poem. There's one about his first daughter, and they're fabulous, and he's reading them.
Wow.
But I couldn't quote those poems because they're not published. I would argue that because he read them publicly, but no, published means in a bound book.
Right. Yeah. And then what about his family? Were you able to interview many family members?
I interviewed some of the family members. His brother Richard, the younger brother, who was a lot younger, he was so helpful. He gave me some photographs. And some of his cousins. His second wife, she didn't want to be interviewed for the book. And I left her. I called friends. I called relatives. I went to where she lives in St. Paul, and I put a note in the mailbox, a handwritten note. And she didn't want to talk. And, you can't make somebody talk.
Right.
The third widow, his third wife, is the executor of the estate. And I had interviewed her several times before I started working on this book, because when I wrote the retrospective of him in 2005, I did a lot of interviews, which were extremely helpful. And she's been quoted elsewhere, but I didn't interview her specifically for the book.
And what about his daughter?
His daughter I did interview, yeah. Uh-huh. His first daughter. He has two daughters. Sakina was with Brenda Burton, his first wife. And I did a very, very long interview with her, yeah.
And his youngest daughter?
I met her. We went to the opening of the film Fences at Lincoln Center with all the big stars. I met her then, but I didn't interview her for the book. Yeah.
Okay. How long did it take you to write this book, and what was your writing process?
Yeah, well, it took me 6 years total. The one blessing of the pandemic was that the libraries closed and nobody was flying and you couldn't go to people's houses, so I had to start writing. And that's when I wrote the book. In terms of process, I heard another writer speak at the very beginning of this process, and he said he had a little banker's box, not the gigantic ones, but small ones for each chapter. So I got one, and I had one for each chapter. And I had one for each play. And so when I had documents and when I had, you know, interviews that I had done, I put them all in those boxes. So it's kind of old-fashioned. Most people would have little things on their computer, but my computer desktop is a mess. So I had that. I wrote that prologue very early on, when I had the eureka moment that this portrait of him at this time of his life really says a lot. And I probably wrote that 25 times. I kept rewriting it and rewriting it. And the story behind Fences, the play, the production, there's a lot of backstage drama in that. And I wrote that early on. But those two things were the things I wrote as I was researching. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote the rest of the book. And I would not recommend doing that. The next book I write, I will write, even if it's a draft, as I go along. You find one of those documents or eureka moment, you write about it. It doesn't have to be in the right place, but sitting down and combing through all of those boxes was a laborious process. It was joyful in a way, but that's my advice, is write as you go.
Okay. And yeah. Then last thing is, any recommendations that you would have for other biographers who want to write about the life
of the
artist?
You know, you can't separate the dancer from the dance, in my opinion, especially with someone like August Wilson, where his city, Seven Guitars, is set in his childhood backyard. He said that there was a piece of him in every single character, and he was not one particular character. So you can't write about an artist without addressing the work and how the work interweaves with the life, how it shows up. I think biographies that don't do that, they just tell the story of the life. And I'm thinking of one in particular. I'm not going to mention which one it is. You don't get a full portrait of the person. Mm-hmm. But you also have to do it in a way where you're talking to readers who may not have read all of these things. So there's a lot of explaining you have to do.
Right.
But
right.
Not in a way that you're looking down on anybody. You're telling the story of a life, and you're telling the story of 10 plays. And I hope I did him. I hope I did them well.
I think you did.
Thank you so much.
So thank you. Yeah. Really thank appreciate you. It, Patty. That was author Patty Hartigan speaking with me about her book, August Wilson, A Life. It was published by Simon & Schuster in August 2023. We recorded this interview at BIO's annual conference at the Leon Levy Center in the City University of New York in May of this year. To learn more about BIO or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a fantastic day.